The Recap Show is an unfiltered inside look into the world of global soccer and women's sports.
Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.
Folks, recently there was a report about remittances that was done by the Federation for American Immigration Reform. And a remittance is money earned in the U.S. that is transferred to individuals like relatives, friends, or business associates abroad. And these remittance payments may be made by U.S. citizens, legal immigrants, and aliens with lawful status or illegal aliens. And here to talk to us about the impact of same is Ira Melman, Media Director for the Federation for American Immigration Reform. Ira, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Good to be back.
So, Ira, these are outflows, right, from our economy. And I guess anytime you put it in that context, it has a negative connotation.
Yeah, I mean, this is billions and billions of dollars every year that is being sent out of our economy. And you know, what it has is downstream effects. This is money that is not being spent in local communities. It's not helping local businesses create jobs. It's not helping local governments get tax revenues from the money that people spend in those communities. And, you know, in the long run, it doesn't help the receiving countries either. It becomes a crutch rather than make the reforms that are necessary to help people sustain themselves in those countries. What it encourages is for people to leave those countries, come to the United States and send money home. So we're just perpetuating a negative cycle that doesn't work well for the United States and doesn't even really work well for the countries that are on the receiving end of all these remittances.
I guess you can say that because it has to be a huge percentage of the income generated in those countries then if it has that type of impact.
It is in countries in Central America, particularly that, you know, we saw the great wave of migrants coming in under the Biden administration. Guatemala now, 20% of its GDP is accounted for by remittances being sent back by citizens of Guatemala who are now living and working here in the United States. It's not just me saying it or Fair saying it. You have the banking industry in those countries saying that this is a negative thing for those countries because it does create this dependency. It inhibits the kind of reforms that are necessary. The money that is sent back is used for consumption, not investment, which is really what is needed in those countries. There needs to be investment. There needs to be job creation. None of that is happening. You know, the family members who receive it, you know, understandably, they have an interest in getting the money. But, you know, if it's not being used to help develop those economies in the long run, again, it just becomes a Band-Aid on a situation that needs to be rectified.
It's kind of a disruption to the whole way that we view a micro economy, right? I mean, in my former life, I was the tax collector. I was the sheriff and tax collector of our parish. And we kind of looked at things that every dollar, earned and spent in our micro economy would typically turn over about seven times, right? Before you'd see this outflow to some other micro economy. But when you have this direct transfer of funds out of the country in a very short period of time, because they're usually done if there's 26 pay periods every other Friday, right? You can go down to to see where they're shipping the money either by the bank or by Western Union, thank you. I was going to say Wells Fargo, but I knew it wasn't that. The Western Union, shop where these monies are spent. So you don't see that multiple turning over. And that has a significant impact in the local economy.
It does, because every time that money is spent locally, you know, I don't know what the sales tax is in New Orleans or in Louisiana, but every time that money is spent locally, the state of Louisiana gets a few bucks or a percentage of it that the local community probably tax on a few cents. So, you know, these are the sorts of things that these local communities rely on. It pays for the services that people rely on. It pays for, you know, the infrastructure. And, you know, we're also talking about people who are earning very low incomes to begin with, who very often wind up relying on public services. So the money that they're earning locally is being sent out of the country. In the meantime, the local governments are not collecting any revenues on it. And at the same time, you've got kids in school, you've got other expenses that these local governments have to incur by the presence of these people. So it definitely harms the United States and the local communities where these people are living and working. And we're also talking in many cases about people who are doing jobs that might otherwise be done by American workers at higher wages. And these people are far more likely to be spending their money locally and you know, doing the sorts of things that we just discussed that benefit the community in general.
Absolutely, because the consumption of the services of these folks that are here that are sending these remittances back, I know here locally in the parish where I live, sales tax is a large part of the funding formula for law enforcement, schools, drainage, all kinds of different things that are provided as services here.
Right. So, yes, and that's exactly, you know, why this is a problem both for the United States and the receiving countries. Here in this country, you know, we lose out on all that revenue that is generated by, you know, the same dollar being spent in seven different places. And at the same time, you know, other people are losing out on job opportunities. Local businesses rely on this revenue to create new jobs. So, you know, if the money is not being spent locally, I'm sure some economists can tell you for every X number of dollars that are spent locally, you create one new job. And that's important to not just to the community, but to people who are seeking jobs. So it you know, the dollar amount is significant to begin with, and then you have all these downstream effects that result from the fact that this money is being shipped out of our country.
And the difference here is that we're shipping out about $200 billion and we're only taking in with remittances of $7 billion. So there's a huge differential there. The delta is huge.
That's correct. Yeah. You know, the flow is primarily one way. You know, people come to the United States because, understandably, they're looking for jobs that pay more than they could earn in their home countries. You know, you've got this system that has developed where, you know, you simply have to send your best and your brightest workers abroad because there's no opportunities for them in their home countries. The families back home rely on the fact that they're going to have family members living and working in the United States. So it just becomes a vicious cycle that perpetuates itself rather than addressing the root causes of the problem, which is that the corruption, the economic stagnation in those countries. We'd be far better off if we encourage people to stay in those countries. You know, the United States can assist in helping people develop. But this, as I said, you know, it's like providing a drink to an alcoholic. It, you know, gets them over a tough period, but in the long run, it doesn't really help anything.
Well, when you begin to see the benefit to these countries, and I'll just use that term loosely, economically, El Salvador is 23% of their GDP. I mean, that's huge. Honduras is 21% of their GDP. I mean, these are staggering numbers. The Dominican Republic, 8.4% of their GDP. And you pointed out Guatemala earlier at 17.1%. In Mexico, where there's $52 billion a year in remittances made there, that's 4% of their GDP. These are big numbers.
They are. And, you know, it's the percentages that really matter. When you have to rely on remittances for nearly a quarter of your GDP, you know, that tells you that there's something structurally wrong in those countries, and it's not going to be fixed in this way. You know, it's wonderful for the families back home. You know, they can now put food on the table. You know, nobody diminishes the importance of that. But at the same time, It is not helping those countries develop, becoming self-sustaining. No country in the world should have to rely for a quarter of their GDP on sending their workers abroad. It is destructive for those countries, and we're really not helping them.
So there is one state, and y'all point out in the article that Oklahoma levies a fee on remittance transfers, which is used to help fund the public services and benefits that these folks are receiving in Oklahoma, and other states have it under consideration. Has there been a reluctance to do this? Why are people not really kind of jumping on top of this and addressing the situation?
There has been a reluctance, although I should point out in the reconciliation bill that was passed by Congress earlier this month and signed by the president on the 4th of July, there is a 1% federal tax that is tacked on to any remittance that's sent out of the country. But again, that's a very small amount. You also have to take into consideration that in many cases, the illegal immigrants who are working here are working off the books. They're being paid cash under the table. So there isn't even any taxes taken out when they earn the money. So this is a way of recouping just a small portion of what is being sent out. But it should be a consideration for state and local governments, if they're, especially in states where there's large numbers of people who are sending money out of the country, they should be able to impose some kind of tax like Oklahoma has done in order to recoup some money to help pay for the services that they're providing.
Yeah. What's interesting, I know what people are going to say, well, if you put these fees on, they're just going to send cash through the mail. And my response is no, they won't, because once the receiving postal service over there in El Salvador understands how this is now working, they'll be going through all these envelopes, right? The level of corruption in some of these countries is just incredulous.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't send cash in the mail in this country, much less to, you know, a country where you have that kind of corruption. Look, I mean, they'll always try to find ways around this. But, you know, the bottom line is that it's a system that just perpetuates itself. It doesn't really help anybody in the long run, and it needs to be addressed. And, you know, certainly from our own end, we need to recognize the impact that it's having on other people's jobs, on the ability of communities to provide the kind of services that taxpayers expect. So, you know, we took a step. It, actually, in the reconciliation bill, it was originally going to be 3.5%. The lobbyists got it down to 1%, but it certainly opens the door to increasing the amount of money that we can collect on the way out of the country.
Yeah, and interestingly, I was very surprised to learn, and y'all report on this in your article, that a lot of these countries like Mexico, their banking system seems to keep pretty damn good records on as it relates to these remittances that are flowing through the banking system there.
Yeah, look, I mean, as you pointed out, it accounts for a significant portion of their GDP. They want to know where the money is coming from, who it's going to. And I suspect that they're taxing it on the other end as well. So, you know, if they're doing it, there's no reason why we shouldn't be doing it also.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of interesting because I know the critics would say, well, here you are, you're treating them unfairly. Their own country that they're sending the money back to is taxing that money almost without exception.
Yeah. Look, I mean, people earn the money. They should be able to send it to their families. That's, you know, but we shouldn't be creating a system that allows the money to be drained out of our communities where it's needed as well. So all of this is understandable. I think everybody understands why somebody from a poor country would send a relative to the United States to earn money and send money back. You know, that's not an issue. We all understand that. The issue here is that in the long run, it doesn't help anything. And in many cases, it might actually make situations worse And that's what really needs to stop. So we're hurting both ourselves, and we're kind of inhibiting economic development in those countries. And as I said, in the long run, that helps nobody.
Ira, if we could pivot real quick, we just have a couple of minutes. The other day, there was a report that they that the Trump administration now believes that the number of immigrant children, illegal immigrant children that came across the border and are kind of lost and out there, nobody knows where they are, that number originally was thought to be, I think, around 345,000 folks. They're now saying that that number is probably more like 450,000. Did you hear that and your reaction?
Yeah. They just had a hearing, the House Homeland Security Committee. Clay Higgins from Louisiana, is one of the members of that committee who was questioning some of these folks at the Department of Health and Human Services, which was the government agency that took control of these kids after they were released at the border. And, you know, what they're finding is that they were just, the HHS was simply handing these kids over to any sponsor who showed up. Very little vetting. As one of them pointed out, you have to show more information about yourself when you go to adopt a pet than when you take custody of one of these unaccompanied minors. And what we've been finding is that these kids are being put into situations that no child should have to endure. They're working at very hard jobs, and those are the lucky ones. They've also been handed over to sex traffickers. These are all sorts of awful things that are happening to these kids because under the Biden administration, the pressure was just get them out the door. Anybody who shows up to claim these kids, just hand them over. And we're now seeing the results. We don't know where a lot of these kids are. We don't know in whose hands they've wound up or what they're being forced to do. And it's a disgrace. In the United States, this should not happen to any child, regardless of their immigration status. We should not be tolerating it, much less facilitating it.
I have a strong suspicion that that number is going to grow. I just don't, I think it's probably worse than that, just because when you look at these numbers, all of these calculations have actually grown in what folks are predictions as to what people are saying actually crossed now that we're able to get our hands around some data. And then with the gotaways, you don't ever know, but they're not moving in the other direction. They're all growing. Your thoughts?
Yeah. We have at least stopped the influx now. Since January and the new administration coming in, we're not seeing the huge influxes. We're also not seeing that Health and Human Services is just giving kids to anybody who shows up. So we've stopped the problem from getting worse, but we have a huge problem that was already existing. As you pointed out, 400,000 plus that we know about, there may be more. And the imperative is we have to go out and find these kids, make sure that they're not in the hands of people who are abusing them, and taking strong action against anybody who has been taking advantage of these kids. Again, this is not something that we should tolerate in this country, regardless of what the immigration status is of the kids.
That's an absolute horrendous outcome. And what makes it even worse is at some point in time, as they go through the maturation process, they grow up, they get older, the social service demand is going to be incredible. Mental health right. issues, it's always a byproduct of all of this that's going on. And these services are woefully underfunded now. We've succeeded in creating a problem that we may not ever be able to address, the downstream implications that is.
Exactly. You know, we cannot change the past. All we can do is go out there and try to, you know, fix whatever problems arise as a result of what has gone on. But certainly, you know, we have now seen the implications of having open borders, of having a policy where we simply let people into the country, release them, including children, into the hands of people who we don't really know what their relationship with the kids are. We created this problem. We're going to have to grapple with the downstream effects. But, you know, as I said, you cannot go back and undo what has already been done. You just have to do the best you can to minimize the impact of those really awful policies that took place over 4 years.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, as always, Ira Melman. We appreciate your time, your insight, Media Director for Federation for American Immigration Reform. Have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too.
We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. We'll go to the talk lines when we return. Give us a shout. Stay with us.
I'm Kristen Press.
And I'm Tobin Heath.
We're World Cup winners, Olympians, and the hosts of The Recap Show.
Every week, we sit down with the icons, disruptors, and game changers on the field and beyond it to talk victories, heartbreaks, and everything in between.
We've built a space where athletes, changemakers, and people creating the future of women's sports can show up and show off as their full, unapologetic selves.
Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, I guess I have to talk about this because of the, you know, the partisan nature of all of this, because no matter what I say, what topic I talk about, I get a series of texts from a bunch of different folks. Why are you not talking about the Epstein files? So let me go on a record again so that everybody understands exactly where I stand. I said from early onset, once I consumed all of the information for me to draw and formulate my opinion on this matter, release the files. Invite Ghislaine Maxwell to testify before Congress. And let's tell it all. And let's put it behind us. And if there was anybody that's in those files where they can establish probable cause to arrest those individuals for having sex with an underage female, they should be charged, plain and simple. Now, I don't know what's in the files. I don't know that, you know, there's any of that information there. What I do know is that the previous administration, the Biden administration, had access to the files and they did nothing. And they chose not to release any of the information or anything else. There's been this resurgence here now by both Democrats and Republicans, myself included, because I'm sick and tired of hearing about the Epstein files. What did he kill himself? I don't know. I don't care. Quite frankly, he probably got what he deserved. Either way. Doesn't matter to me. But the fact of the matter is, the Trump administration is guilty of providing some titillating details and really getting folks' curiosity up as it relates to these files. So release them. And if they can go after individuals there, they should. The Biden administration had that opportunity. They should have. They obviously didn't, and they obviously didn't release the files. I got to imagine if there was something there that was salacious relative to Trump, one way or another, that was coming out. So I don't know that there's a high probability that there's going to be anything criminal in nature or otherwise that you're going to find in those files, because they had them and it didn't modify their behavior. Their behavior in the past is well known that they would have leaked that information at some point in time. So But it wouldn't matter to me either way. I don't care. Let the chips fall where they may. It is what it is, and it ain't going to change. Release it. Now, unfortunately, there's all kinds of rules that have to be followed by DOJ. The grand jury in Florida rejected the request to open the grand jury proceedings in the state case against Jeffrey Epstein, where allegedly a lot of the salacious details of the activities of the, on that island and in his life were revealed. And then others that say that they were privy because of their representation of certain folks during the course of that investigation say that that grand jury testimony is devoid of a lot of that. I don't know who to believe or who not to believe. But, you know, we've gone absolutely hog wild crazy over the Epstein files, and nobody really knows what's in there. It's conjecture. You know, and if they have somebody wishing him happy birthday on a list, so what? A lot of people used to be his friends, and a lot of people parted when, you know, a lot of these revelations started to be made public. It doesn't mean that every single solitary person that he ever came in contact knew, actually had knowledge of what this guy was about. I would ask you. You're not surprised in your lifetime about things that you've come to learn about not only people in your family, but maybe some close friends. Right? I think it's happened to everybody. So, I mean, you know, it is what it is. If there's something that's of any value, release it. I mean, I don't know where else to go with this. It's consuming a lot of people's time. I would be more interested in a much more detailed look into our intelligence community and the manipulation and manufacture of information there, if that's true. I'd love to see an unredacted copy of all of that stuff to gain a better understanding of who did what, when, and how, why, and how, in order to put in systems to make sure that these two parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, are not to be trusted any longer. Because obviously they can't handle that information. And quite frankly, you know, the bastardization of the Intelligence Committee in Congress and the way that they are, it used to be that they would not say a word, nothing, zippo. I mean, it was kind of, you know, not accepted to even ask the questions. The response would be, you know, I can't talk about that. You don't hear that often anymore. We give nuanced responses so that we can get a click and, you know, somebody can get a headline and we're off and running. And they're all guilty of it. And the one that it harms more than anybody else is us. Because we don't know what to ultimately make of it, because we don't totally understand all the players in the game up there in Washington. Even as much as I follow it and others follow it, we don't know about all the games. There are all kinds of games and misdirection and stuff going on about that. So, you know, it's just, I think we've kind of lost sight here a little bit, but release it. That's where I am. Release it. I'm done. I mean, it's just the only way that you're going to bring a closure to this and stop the conjecture, because both parties are fueling it, is to release the files. And maybe there's an important lesson to be learned here by these folks up in D.C., and especially Pam Bondi, in the manner in which she responded to some of these questions. She didn't have to say anything. She could have just simply said, the file's on my desk. I hadn't reviewed it yet. I don't know what's in there. We were committed to look through the files to see whether or not there's anything there, and we're going through the process. And I'm not at liberty to talk about it any more than that at this juncture. But no, that's not how we responded. We responded in a way that really piqued everybody's curiosity that there are potentially smoking guns in these files. We don't know what's in these files. All right, let's go to Joe. Joe, you're up. What say you?
Yeah, how you doing, Mr. Rhino?
Yeah, thank you, sir. I wear that with a badge of honor.
Yeah, a few months back, I spoke to you about your supper with your wife and Mark Morial, calling Mark Morial a friend of yours. Is he still a friend since he invited Al Sharpton to speak at his mother's funeral? Is he still your friend? Yeah.
Yes.
Still your friend.
He was a classmate from high school. I respect Mark Morial. Until he gives me damn good reason to not respect him, just because
if that's not,
he has
if
a
that's
different
not good enough reason, you a trophy to the Democrats. You a disgrace.
Well, thank you, Joe. I appreciate that.
The whole bunch of them: Troy Carter, Cedric Richmond, Mitch Morial, James Carville, Mark Morial, they all disgraces to New Orleans. And you a friend of Mark Morial. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it. Because you pointed out something that I'm actually very proud of. I've actually stepped across the aisle and endorsed people that had a D behind their name. And I did so because the candidates that we put up that had an R behind their name, I did not think they were worthy of that brand, nor were they worthy of holding the office that they had qualified for. And I'm not afraid to do it again. In fact, I suspect that it will happen again in my lifetime. And I'm not going to support an R or vote for an R just for the sake of the fact that I have a R behind my name. Does everybody in life do everything perfect, and does everybody in life align totally with your way of thinking? Of course not. My wife is a very successful lawyer, independent thinking individual. I love her for that, and we are not on the same page on a whole lot of issues. And I love the fact that we can have conversations about that. Some might call them a debate. And it's okay. It's a healthy thing. I love hearing from the other side. I learn a lot. I listen closely. I drink wine with these folks. I dine with these folks. I love and am proud to call them my friend. Do we agree on everything? Absolutely not. Nor will we ever. And if you want to castigate me and call me a rhino or whatever, you should call everybody then up there a rhino, because, folks, what you see on TV is just one perspective of D.C. I know for a fact that the backdrop is a lot of those folks are having a beer together in the afternoon. In many respects, unfortunately, it's almost become a show. But I love, you know what made Louisiana so popular and so strong in D.C.? Was the number of centrists that we had up there. I mean, they were the best. They were the ones that brought people together. It's why we developed the power base that we did in Washington. It was great. Because we were able to swim through all the bullshit that was up there and bring people together. I think that's what we ought to all be looking for. And we're not going to start from a place of hate. Joe, think about that. We'll be right.
The Recap Show is an unfiltered inside look into the world of global soccer and women's sports.
Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.
Right back. Newell, I waited tables at the Capitol Grill on Pennsylvania Avenue in D.C., and my tables were full of D's and R's drinking and eating together, laughing and talking in a civilized manner. Absolutely. You have to. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. Let's go to Sam. Sam, you're up.
Hey, Newell, not that you need my defense or something, but us Jays have to stick together. I also knew Mark in high school. It's ironic because, if you remember, his personality was, like, so angry then, and I'm thinking, man, this kid, his family's like, what's he so PO'd about, right? We actually mm-hmm. almost got in a fight in high school, but, you know, we all grow up. In later years, I've run into him doing transportation. You know, I've never driven for him or my sibling, but, like, I would run into him, and we'd chit-chat a little bit and all that. And if we don't have communication, we can't understand anybody's point of view. A couple of things, too. Governor Edwards is the best governor that I could remember in the longest. He's a conservative Democrat to the point to where President Trump was trying to recruit him. And Governor Edwards said, sir, I am so flattered. He says, I cannot change parties because people voted for me as a Democrat.
Yeah.
And also personally, Troy Carter's assistant, Seldon Jones, has tried his best with many roadblocks to assist me in a Social Security disability dispute. They lost 2/3 of my paperwork and medical records. You know, he got 1/3 back. You know, so it's pretty bad when Social Security will run over the assistant of a United States congressman. But that's Social Security. We, with all these problems, we have to talk to, and I'm a conservative. I'm a Ted Nugent, John Boyd conservative. I've always believed that we leave the personal attacks to the liberals. You go to personal attacks when you don't have any kind of, like, backing for your point of view. That's when you go to personal.
Yeah.
And all this personal stuff, it's like, when you do that, that means you don't have any kind of substantiation to your point of view. But man, I had to call in. I said, man, hey look, you know, because there's things I disagree with you on, but man, we're all in this together. We got to fix this. You know, it's, you know, but yeah, we got to leave the personal attacks to the liberals, you know. And
they shouldn't be doing it either. We should be exercising emotional intelligence, you know, and I try to adhere to that every day. Am I successful every day? No. I'm fallible. I make mistakes. You know, I think back when I was just kind of chuckling when you thinking back to some of the stupid stuff we did in high school. I said, man, I wouldn't want to be judged by what I did in high school. No way, no how. I mean, you know,
we both had dealings with Mr. Frederick. You know, I'm sure there is one. I cannot think of any one issue I agree with Mark on. Nice guy. You know, his mom, I wish I would have met her before she passed. You know, a saint of a woman. His dad, that's another discussion. But, I mean, I can't think of one issue I agree with Mark on. I'm sure there's one or two. Just can't think, you know, but we can't have a discussion. And how do you expect them to see our point of view if we're name-calling and this, that, and the other thing? You know, when someone
absolutely.
Starts that, guess what? My ears turn off.
Well, the reality is a lot of times when you get in deep conversation with folks that, you know, that have a different mindset than you, you find out that there's more common ground than there are differences. You know, and it's amazing how you go through this process and you say, well, we actually agree on more than we disagree on, you know, because there's so many nuances to every topic that we talk about. It's just taking the time and, you know, being the adult in the room and just sitting down and listening. It doesn't have to be about an attack. Sam, thank you so much for the call. Have a great weekend. We'll be right back, folks. We'll check in with Scoot when we return, so stay with us. On a text line, I voted for Governor Edwards as a military academy graduate. It didn't bother me that he was a Democrat. He was a rational leader. No party affiliation here. Scoot joins us. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
Hey, I wouldn't want to be George Santos today. I wonder if he's bringing any of those dresses with him to prison.
How about ever?
Yeah, right. All right, we'll talk about South Park, and there's a headline: South Park apologizes for Trump episode, but they really didn't apologize, and it's Free for All Friday.
I thought it was funny.
Oh, I thought it was a for they showed his little tinkle.
Have a great weekend. Sorry.
The Recap Show is an unfiltered inside look into the world of global soccer and women's sports.
Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.